Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today, produced in association with the University of Southern California.
More than anything else, this economy needs jobs. You'd think companies and workers would agree on that. As with so many things, though, kind of depends on which side of that discussion you're on. Jobs as bargaining chips on the broadcast today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by PBS, presenting Ken Burns' Prohibition, a look at the law that turned America lawless, starting Sunday at 8, 7 Central on PBS. And by Constant Contact, combining email marketing and social media for more customers and more time back on the clock. Learn more at ConstantContact.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Thursday, today the 29th of September. Good to have you with us. 7,000 jobs in the whole American economy is something like 4/1,000ths of 1% of the entire workforce. But it speaks volumes about just how desperate things are that even such a relatively small number of new jobs has become a point of contention. Ford announced back in January it's planning to hire 7,000 people over the next 2 years. Bloomberg News reported today that those jobs have become a bargaining chip for Ford in its negotiations with the United Auto Workers. Marketplace's Elisa Roth has more.
Neither Ford nor the UAW will talk about the contract negotiations until they come to an agreement. But Ford is reportedly dangling the promise of as many as 10,000 jobs. Alex Colvin is a professor of labor relations at Cornell University. He says back in the 50s and 60s, jobs weren't usually part of these kinds of negotiations because they didn't have to be.
Nowadays, employment goes up and down a lot more depending on the competitiveness of the business. And so as a result, it can be much more of a bargaining chip in either direction, either the possibility of increased employment or protections against loss of employment.
Ford already announced it would create roughly 7,000 new jobs in the next 2 years, around 6,000 manufacturing jobs and 750 engineering ones. But there's still a lot of room for negotiation on questions like whether workers who've been laid off will get first dibs and whether jobs that have been moved overseas could be brought back. Gary Chason is a professor of labor relations at Clark University. He says workers have been forced to make a lot of concessions recently on issues like wages and health care. And now that Ford is doing well again, the UAW is trying to get some of those benefits back.
The main scenario that we're seeing here is that Ford is holding out the enticement of saving jobs and saying that this is the quid pro quo if the union does not ask to have everything reversed all at once.
Ford workers aren't the only ones using jobs as leverage in their union negotiations. Yesterday, the UAW signed a new contract with GM that includes the promise of 6,400 new jobs. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Drivers in Maine will soon be living life in the somewhat faster lane. As soon as highway workers get new signs posted, early next week or so, the top speed limit's going to be 75 miles an hour along a 100-mile stretch of I-95. The new speed limit down east is going to be the fastest anywhere east of the Mississippi, and it's a trend you'd think the truckers on tight timetables might appreciate. But our senior business correspondent Bob Moon reports that one truckers group actually wants Congress to slow things down.
Sounds quaint, but back in the 1970s, encouraging people to drive slower was considered a public service.
At 55 miles per hour, you save gasoline, which is real money these days. But 55 miles per hour saves you more than that. 55 saves lives.
My, how things have changed since Congress repealed the national speed law in 1995.
States have been basically falling over themselves, raising speed limits, even though it's a safety problem and it uses more fuel.
That's Russ Rader, who speaks for the Insurance Institute for Highway Safety. It's that hit-to-fuel economy that's gotten the attention of the trucking industry. At the American Trucking Association's, Sean McNally says 65 miles per hour is a kind of sweet spot.
We found that a truck traveling 65 uses 27% less fuel than one traveling at 75. So if we reduce truck speeds to 65, we save 2.8 billion gallons of fuel a year.
So McNally says the truckers group is prepared to back up that finding with action.
We've petitioned the federal government to require trucks to have electronic governors on them to keep them at or below 65.
But Gary Biller of the National Motorists Association argues the whole idea is setting a smooth, constant speed.
Actually, it's better for fuel economy, even at a higher speed, because you've got less braking, less accelerating, and traffic just flows a lot freer.
Biller also contends fatality rates have fallen since the 55 repeal, but the insurance industry's Russ Rader says speed still cuts reaction time and makes crashes more severe.
If we as a society decide getting people to their destinations faster is a priority, we also have to understand it means more people will die.
Rader calls that a costly trade-off. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Wall Street was a little undecided this Thursday. The Germans passed a European bailout package. That's good. There were late-day worries, though, about some Chinese companies listed on American stock exchanges. That, as you might imagine, is bad. And so the major indices ended split. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. This has happened to you, right? That you feel maybe like you've gotten stuck in your job, hit a professional plateau. Happens to everybody at some point, probably. But what if you had a coach, somebody to keep an eye on you, make suggestions for improving your game? Surgeon and New Yorker magazine staff writer Atul Gawande got stuck. He sought out some answers and wrote about it in the magazine this week. We reached him at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, where he works. Good to have you with us.
Great to be here.
So listen, tell me about your tennis game.
My tennis game, well, you know, I'm middle-aged now, so it's gone to the pits. But a tennis coach, some kid out of college, added 10 miles an hour to my serve in about 10 minutes. And I was serving harder than I'd ever served as a teenager. Hmm. And then I got thinking when I saw that Rafael Nadal had a coach. Why do top athletes have coaches? But in surgery, I wouldn't imagine paying someone or even having someone come into my operating room, watch me operate, and try to tell me what I'm doing.
That's a great question. Do you suppose it's like a subjective thing? I mean, you eventually, not to bury the lead, but you eventually went out and got a former teacher of yours, and you said, listen, come into the operating room with me and have a look. How did you get there?
The tipping point for me was that when I talked to people who are really at the top of what they do, who hadn't had coaches, they had found people who were kind of like coaches. You know, if you're a violinist, for example, you go to Juilliard, you graduate, you go get your 10,000 hours of practice on your own, and you rise to be the cream of the crop, become Itzhak Perlman. I called Itzhak Perlman. He actually returned my phone call, which is an amazing thing. And I said, so, you know, why do singers and athletes have coaches but violinists don't? And he said, I don't know, but it's a mistake. And in his entire career, he had a coach. His wife, she had spent her career in the audience watching him as his outside ears, critiquing, suggesting ways that he could improve and tweak, and going from very, very good to what he did to probably the best of his generation.
You, though, I mean, you've done those operations 1,000 times, right? So you don't really think about them anymore. What more can a coach give you in that environment?
Getting better at what we do is about taking areas of your unconscious incompetence and making it more conscious to yourself. But I think what they do is they are able to break down performances, whether it's a sport or anything else, into its component parts. This came out in the school world. So when I watched the teacher coaches at work, they would sit with the teachers afterwards and say, okay, there's a bunch of things we got to work on. There's how you manage your time. There's how you planned that class. We can't work it all at once, so let's break it down into the components and let's work at these one at a time. That ability to see the details that create success is what they do.
This eighth grade teacher, I think it was, the math teacher out in Albemarle County, who was so receptive to having the coach there and more importantly, letting you watch it and write about it. How did it work out for her?
So, you know, this was someone who was 10 years into her career, and as she put it, she'd hit the wall. She was exhausted. She'd run out of new things to try, but she also was very good at what she did. And so having someone come in made her stop feeling burned out. Probably the most valuable thing was not only did this coach help her get a little bit better in how she taught her eighth grade math students, but it also made her like that job again and not quit and go on to something else.
Surgeon Atul Gawande. You can read more about what happened when he got his own coach in the operating room. It's his article in The New Yorker this week is on our website. It's marketplace.org. There was a big United Nations meeting in Copenhagen, Denmark today about the famine and growing humanitarian crisis in Somalia. Drought has left 4 million people there and in other parts of East Africa without enough food. Relief agencies say they simply don't have the resources to keep up. Some social entrepreneurs, though, in the Northeast United States say they might. Susan Shepherd reports.
The sprawling settlement of Kibera, Kenya, is one of the largest slums in the world. Nearly 200,000 people pack its dirt paths and metal shacks. Children are 15 times more likely to suffer from malnutrition here than in Kenya as a whole. Kanini is one of the many kids who pass through this health clinic in Kibera every week. She sits on her grandma's lap as nurses examine her. Kanini's a year and a half, but she's got the spindly legs of a five-month-old and can't walk. Angeline Mujiku is one of the nurses.
The parents gave birth to the child. She was so underweight. She has been malnutrition all through.
In clinics like this around the world, the best-known treatment for malnutrition is something called ready-to-use therapeutic food. It's made from peanuts and comes in a foil packet. Relief agencies call it a breakthrough and are using it to provide calories and vitamins to roughly 2 million kids who don't get enough to eat. It needs no refrigeration or water. The only thing it does require is money. And one place that's coming from is a startup called 2Degrees Food. Lauren Walters is one of the co-founders.
We make these healthy, nutritious, gluten-free bars, 2Degrees bars. And for every bar that's sold in the United States, we purchase and then donate a nutrition pack to a severely malnourished kid.
It's yet another energy bar in a market that's saturated with them. But their strategy to stand out from the crowd is to play up the hunger relief side of their business model. And it's worked with Karen Bukas. She's the food buyer for a chain of upscale coffee shops in the Northeast.
There's so many people that want to sell things, especially in a coffee store like this. I don't want to clutter the register with items that don't mean something.
The chain gives 2% of its profits to local charities, so 2Degrees appealed to her.
We stopped selling every other bar, so now we just solely carry 2Degrees bars.
Now 2Degrees is going national, selling in Whole Foods markets. And that's exactly what Lee Fern wants to hear. He's one of 20 venture capital investors who gave 2Degrees more than $1 million in startup funds.
I think this has potential to be a very good investment opportunity. I wouldn't have put money into it if I didn't think that way.
Since January, the company has sold nearly $200,000 in energy bars. And it's contracted with relief agencies to distribute 60,000 nutrition packets. The first shipment arrived in Kibera last month. Nurse Angeline Mujiku says it should help reverse the ravages of malnutrition in a kid like 18-month-old Kanini.
I would say the much this child will get from this supplement, it's going to save a child's life.
2Degrees co-founder Lauren Walters says the company is on track to donate 150,000 more packets by the end of the year. In Kibera, Kenya, I'm Susan Shepherd for Marketplace.
Coming up, turn on, tune in, drop out.
Since I made the film, my family and I unplug one day a week doing a technology Shabbat because it was overwhelming me to be online 24/7.
On Living Life, connected. But first, yeah, what the heck, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials climbed 1.3% today, 143 points, ended at 11,153. The blue chips did. The NASDAQ fell 0.4%, 10 points, finished at 2480. The S&P 500 put on 0.8%, 9 points, closed at 1160. Banks pulled higher today on some better-than-ho-hum economic news. Bank of America gained 3%. JPMorgan Chase jumped 3% as well. Citigroup cranked up nearly 4% today. Might have been all smiles in the financial sector, but retail and technology were under the gun today. Advanced Micro Devices plowed down more than 13% after it said it was having problems getting its chips made. Intel fell 0.5%. Netflix plunged almost 11% today on some takeover talk. Tiffany tumbled nearly 7% as well. The 10-year T-note fell, the yield rose to 1.995%. We like to be precise here. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Allianz, providing investment, insurance, and retirement solutions through its affiliated companies in the U.S. since 1896. AllianzUSA.com. By Chevrolet, maker of the new Volt, which plugs in anywhere and goes everywhere. Available in select markets. Details at ChevyVolt.com. And by Progressive Insurance, with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on mileage and safe driving habits. Learn more at Progressive.com. If you missed the broadcast, you can still catch Marketplace. Go to our website and click on Podcasts. You'll also find our new podcasts, The Midday Update, Freakonomics, and The Tech Report, all at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on personal income and spending for August. Tomorrow is the last day of the federal fiscal year. And Major League Baseball playoffs begin with two games, the Rays versus the Rangers and the Yankees versus the Tigers. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. So I went to the farmer's market this past weekend, shelled out $8 for a three-pack of organic strawberries. Not entirely clear, though, that I got what I thought I was getting. Marketplace's Adrienne Hill has the story.
To grow a strawberry, you need a strawberry plant. So you might think that to grow an organic strawberry, you'd need an organic strawberry plant. You'd be wrong. If a farmer can make a case that they can't get the type or quality or quantity of organic plants they need, they can buy conventional and then grow them organically.
The organic farmers take the conventional plants, put them in the ground, and the first berry that pops out, that's called organic.
California nurseryman James Rickerts used to grow organic strawberry plants, but he says many California farmers would use the loophole to buy non-organic starters, so he stopped growing.
Sustainable agriculture isn't sustainable when you're not making any money at it.
Now, organic farmer Jim Cochran, who used to buy from Rickerts, doesn't have a choice. This year, he had to plant conventional strawberry starters.
That's the heart of the problem, because right now there are no growers of organic transplants.
The farmers have asked the USDA to change its guidance on organic seeds and seedlings to help encourage a market for them. It's a move Paul Towers from the Pesticide Action Network thinks could bring the industry in line with what organics consumers think they're buying.
When we call something organic, it should be organic from seed to fruit.
USDA spokesperson Sue Kim says the agency is reviewing the criteria that farmers use to get waivers from using organic plants, but points out there's a lot that goes into that organic label, including everything that happens and doesn't happen to a plant once it's in the ground. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
If you get good grades and if you test well, Seton Hall University in northern New Jersey has a deal for you. The school says it's going to offer top-notch prospects as much as 60% off tuition from $30,000 a year down to $10,000. Eric Hoover has been covering the story for the Chronicle of Higher Education. Eric, good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
What did Seton Hall have to say yesterday when it made this announcement about why it was doing it?
Well, I had a brief chat with Seton Hall's Vice President for Enrollment Management, and she told me that there were two issues that drove this decision. And the first was a sensitivity to the concern about the high cost of college, whether it's Seton Hall or pretty much any other college, private or public. And the second thing is a widespread confusion about costs, and that is, here's a college's sticker price, and what does that mean? What will I end up paying? And of course, as we know, the answer will depend on who you are, what your grades are, how much money your parents make, colleges have done the world no favor by charging all kinds of different rates. And there are some good reasons why colleges charge different rates, but they don't always make sense.
Yeah, you know, so my first thought was cynical, and it went like this. Man, this is pretty good marketing for Seton Hall.
Absolutely. Colleges are more than businesses, of course. They're institutions that serve a public good, but they're also businesses, and they must operate as such. And any business needs a way to talk about itself, a way to tell a story to the world about itself. And when you see a big story about your announcement in the New York Times, I'd say you've succeeded in generating
a
buzz.
Yeah. There's also an element of this that is wrapped up in the much more significant discussion, really, of need-based aid versus merit-based aid in colleges, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, the folks at Seton Hall say this will not weaken their commitment to awarding need-based aid. And, in fact, if you look at this, you know, Seton Hall is calling this a tuition cut. So
for the smarter kids, right?
Yeah, for kids who meet these three definitions of academic merit or smarts or whatever, and so they're paying less. So it'll be interesting to see over time how that shakes out.
Yeah. Quickly, before I let you go, you know, colleges are, in this regard, a little bit like airlines, right? I mean, once an airline announces a price cut or a price increase, all the other airlines follow suit. And the same thing happens in higher education. You see these big tuition announcements or financial aid announcements, and then a bunch of other colleges follow through. Do you think that's going to happen here?
Probably so. I mean, we've heard a lot recently from colleges saying they guarantee that a student will graduate in 4 years or the fifth year is on us. I think it's comforting in some ways to the public. I don't know what necessarily these announcements really mean, how substantial they are. But I certainly do think when you see one or two or three of something, you can suspect that 20 other institutions are going to have their own spin on this kind of announcement because, at least in the front end of this trend, people do take notice.
Eric Hoover is a senior writer at the Chronicle of Higher Education. Eric, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
It is, most of the time, great to be connected, to be able to reach somebody by text or get that nugget of information you need whenever you need it. The flip side, of course, is that other people can reach you too, and there is just so much information out there to be had. It's pretty much the definition of a mixed bag. Tiffany Schlein is a technophile to the core. She founded the Webby Awards, the Oscars of the internet. She thinks about this stuff a lot, and she's put together a new film exploring what exactly it means to be so connected. It's called, of course, Connected. It premieres in Los Angeles tomorrow, New York in just a couple of weeks. Tiffany, welcome to the program.
Nice to be here.
This is a very big idea film, and I want to know where the idea came from that made you want to do it.
Well, I think it came from running the Webby Awards for many years and thinking about how the internet was changing the way that we lived. So I know it was a very big subject, and I think it was also growing up in my household where my father, Leonard Schlein, wrote a lot about this stuff. My mom's a psychologist and talked about connectedness emotionally. So I think, you know, it was my upbringing and just what I did for my work for a long time.
You know, it's interesting you mention your upbringing and your dad because he obviously is a huge part of this film. But the subtitle, which I just noticed now as I sat down, actually, was an autobiography about love.
It's actually an autoblogography.
You're absolutely right. See, I should have
we made that
closely.
Word up.
Here we go. It's an autoblogography about love, death, and technology. This is, it's intensely personal. There's your father's passing and the birth of your daughter all wrapped up in your feelings about how this world is changing.
Yeah, you know, when I originally set out to make the film, you know, the film took 4 years. And 2 years in, I remember sitting and watching a rough cut and having that sinking feeling when I'm sure other filmmakers can relate to when I thought, this isn't working. And I'm not connected to the material. And here, my father had just been diagnosed with brain cancer and given 9 months to live the same week I found out I was pregnant. And all I was doing was thinking about connection emotionally. And I thought, how could I be making a film about connectedness and not exploring emotional connectedness, which is where I think so much of our desire to connect through all of these technologies springs from.
Do you think that emotional connection you had or developed, I guess, through the midpoint of making of this film, do you think that influenced what I took to be the message out of this thing, which is that all of the connectedness that we're having now is a net positive?
Hmm. You know, I really hope to trigger a global conversation about connectedness in the 21st century. So I use a lot of history in the film where I show good and bad. So I really wrestle with it myself. I think there's tons of potential. You know, I personally, since I made the film, my family and I unplug one day a week doing a technology Shabbat because it was overwhelming me to be online 24/7 all
the
time.
Do you still do that?
Oh, yeah. It's very profound for me. And I highly recommend it. So as much as I am so excited about the potential of all the minds on the planet being connected and all those diverse ideas helping us tackle the biggest problems of our day, I think we also need to talk about when it's not good to be plugged in.
One of the things that you state explicitly, but not until, you know, an hour something into this movie, is that it's all about growth and expansion and more and more and more. And that's kind of a conversation we've been having around here. You know, how can you keep on growing in our sense economically, but in your sense via connectivity? How can you keep on growing without it all collapsing under its own weight?
Yeah, I feel like there needs to be, again, a discussion about why are we moving so quickly? I mean, the good news is that every time you get a text or an email, you get a hit of oxytocin, which is the empathy hormone and, you know, love and bonding. But there's something called an infinite dopamine loop, where even with information online, you just keep on wanting more and more. Yeah. You can't. It's like sex, drugs, and rock and roll. It's also associated with dopamine. You just can't seem to, you know, it's just you get into this loop. And they've done studies where when you're online searching for information that you just can't seem to get enough. But that's also the best part of being human, is that we're so curious. The reason I have hope is both because of our desire to want to connect and our curiosity. Those two things are going to continue to propel us forward.
Yeah, this is ostensibly a film about technology, but it's really about human beings.
That's exactly right.
Filmmaker Tiffany Schlain, her latest is called Connected. Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much for having me.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation.com, protecting online privacy by removing your personal data from the internet and stopping unwanted email. Reputation.com. And by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, one share of Bank of America could be had at the close this afternoon for $6.35. The country's biggest bank has been in some trouble lately, as you might have heard here and elsewhere, so it's doing whatever it can to get by. That now includes apparently charging people for using their own money. B of A announced today it's going to start charging debit card users monthly fees, $5, starting in January, which gets me back to the share price. Which would you rather have, $5 or a share of B of A? Think about that for a minute. And while you do, I'm going to say this. That's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow climbed 1.3%, 143 points, finished at 11,153, did the blue chips. The NASDAQ fell 0.4%, 10 points, 2480 at the bell. The S&P 500 put on 0.8%, 9 points, closed at 1160. Ben Adair, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Jonathan Karp, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on this program, how to make it in America.
You know, he's that guy that doesn't take no for an answer, you know. I mean, he's trying to venture in a business that he doesn't really know nothing about, but knows that there's a lot of money to be made.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, that's American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.